The little thing. Oh, live. There we go. All right. Hey, folks. Thanks for tuning in to another fun-filled episode of the Banff Podcast. I'm your host, Mike Lafferty. And today, the subject of our comics roundtable is team books. And we're going to talk about teams and great books and maybe some bad books. And joining us here today is a roundtable of sorts. Oh, we're going to do a giveaway with this podcast. We're going to be giving away a copy of Emerald City, Campaign Setting for Mutants and Masterminds 3rd Edition. All you've got to do is email me at mikelaff@gmail.com with an email that says Emerald City Giveaway in the subject line, and I will pick one lucky listener at random, and I will come live on your sofa for a week and eat your food. And at the end of that week, I will give you a copy of Emerald City. But I promise I'll wear, like, jockey shorts at least the whole time, so it won't be as awkward as it might be. So, all right, with that out of the way, let's introduce our roundtable. First is Aid Smith from the UK. How you doing, Aid?
Not too bad, thank you.
Yeah, appreciate you coming. Second up is Mr. Chris Rutkowski, who is the godfather of the Bash role-playing system. How you doing, Chris?
I'm good. How are you?
Good. Great to have you. And Chris is here to talk comic books, and also, lest we forget, to promote his Kickstarter right now. What's the name of that, Chris?
It's Bash Fantasy Legends of Steel, or you can just look at tinyurl.com/legendsofsteel to get to it. And it's a fantasy RPG, but it's more like a gritty sword and sorcery fantasy RPG.
Sweet. Okay, well, we'll hear more about that later. Moving down the list, we have Mr. Chris McLaughlin, who is also the primary author, I believe, on Emerald City. How you doing, Chris?
I'm great. I don't know if I'm the primary guy, but I'm in there. I'm in there.
You're in there. I thought you were like the big dude on this one.
I did a lot, but it's such a huge book. I didn't break it down by words. I don't know if I necessarily did more than anybody else. I'm in there. I'm proud to be. I'll take that.
All right. Well, if there was like a cage match between you and the other writers of Emerald City, you'd be the one who walked out at the end, right? Like if they put you in a Thunderdome with Darren Vollmer, Walt Chianowski, Seth Johnson, Steve Kinson, John Whitehouser.
I don't know. I'm the only one of those guys. I'm one of the few guys in there that doesn't work out. I mean, unless you know, I could somehow beat them with my devastating vocabulary or something, I'd be in real trouble.
That's with the southern wit and intellect of Chris McLaughlin. You're kind of the Flannery O'Connor of the RPG set, aren't you?
Oh, sir, you're much, much, much too kind. But that's one of the best compliments I could ever possibly be paid. Thank you.
And then anyone else who got my ham-fisted reference to Flannery O'Connor, let me know. I'll send you a dollar.
Aww. So,
hey, next up on the list is Walt Rebilliard. How you doing, Walt?
Although I could possibly hold my own comic, I'm much better on a team book.
Sweet. So you're kind of like Wildcat?
Yeah, only I look nowhere near that good in a leotard.
I got nowhere to go with that joke, Walt. So
we're gonna keep it rolling.
Yeah. All right. So, Chris, you're funny and opinionated. What do you think about team books? What's your favorite?
I'd have to say the Avengers is the one that I've been reading. I basically got the essential Avengers, like 20 years of it from before I was born, and have been slowly reading my way through the black and white reprints of that, and yeah, quite a lot of stuff has happened in the Marvel Universe. I don't even know how they compress the time to bring it up to modern day. I think they just pretend everything that happened in the 60s was 20 years ago, and I think that's just what they do.
I think that's Marvel sliding time, yeah. So how is it reading those black and white reprints? Is it pretty cool, or do you kind of have to, you know?
No, it's good. I know what colors all the characters and stuff are, so I just kind of use my imagination for that part. But it's for the most part, it's good. I mean, they you get a lot of bang for your buck with them. It's basically it's like a pulp paper. It's like a cheaper pulp paper. So you know, don't accidentally drop the book, or you'll like rip half of the pages out of it. But the quality of what you can see is it's fairly good, and even because you have this style of art is very pen heavy, it's very clear and easy to see even without the color I mean, this is before the era of where people were fading the colors and mixing them and stuff anyway. It's like during this time it was all flats, so you're not really missing too much by not having the color.
Okay. Well, I mean, the Avengers is, you know, one of the classic perennial teams. What do you find particularly compelling about this incarnation of the team with the Avengers?
Well, all right, so if I were to compare, all right, so the Avengers versus, say, the Justice League, all right, I just find that the fact that the Avengers deal with issues that seem like contemporary issues of the world that they live in, all right, so the world of, from what I'm reading here, the world of the 1960s and 70s, that's as far as I've gotten. The world of the 1960s and 70s, they're dealing with contemporary issues that are in the news, and or things that might have been contemporary maybe only a couple years ago, like dealing with McCarthyism and stuff like that in the books. But they still deal with stuff that's contemporary. Whereas I think that DC, and especially back in the day, tried to avoid a lot of controversial stuff, which is ironic. Like in the Silver Age, they're trying to avoid all this controversial stuff. In the Golden Age, they had the Justice Society quit and disband because of the various McCarthyist hearings and stuff that were going on. So they just chose to disband the team. So they made like a big protest statement in the 50s, and then like in the 60s, it's like, well, we're going to just pretend all the contemporary issues aren't happening.
Can I jump in just for a second?
Yes, please do.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm not begrudging your choices, sir, because I love the Avengers and 70s and Marvel, especially in the 70s, was great. But the story that you just quoted is actually from the 1979 run in Adventure Comics. The whole thing about the JSA quitting because of McCarthy.
Oh, wasn't put in, man. See, I get fooled by that stuff. I sometimes associate the timeline that they provide with the timeline of when the stuff was created. Like, I used to think, I know better now, but I used to think that, like, Sergeant Rock and Sergeant Fury, that those comics were made in World War II, and I know now that they're not. Yeah.
And just to give DC their due, I must say you baffled me when you say that DC avoided contemporary social issues, and I'm sitting here thinking about this is the company that gave us Hard Traveling Heroes with Green Arrow and Green Lantern.
Wasn't that in like the 80s that they had the whole issue of why haven't you done anything for the Black Man?
That was Hard Traveling Heroes, 1971.
That's not really contemporary though, but.
It was contemporary at the time that it was being published. And then, you know, there's Denny O'Neill's whole run on Justice League. So, I mean, I would grant you that as a rule, maybe Marvel is more into contemporary stuff. But to say that DC ran away with it, you're really doing a disservice to what DC, to Bronze Age DC. Because it could be as hip and groovy as anything being published back in those days.
Okay, but, I mean, if we're looking at Bronze Age DC versus Silver Age DC... Don't you think there was a change there?
Very much so, because DC, Silver Age DC is the same guys who were writing Golden Age DC to a large extent. But but by the 70s, you have writers who are basically ping-ponging back and forth between the two companies, and unless they're being overruled by some like ancient editor like Mort Weisinger, you know, there's a very, very similar vibe between DC and Marvel of that era.
Okay, fair enough. I mean, just in general, the Bronze Age is characterized by a greater engagement with contemporary issues.
It is, but I think we need to give DC credit for starting that with Hard Traveling Heroes.
Okay, fair enough. I will bow to your superior comic scholarship.
Thank you.
So, and Mr. McLaughlin, since you're speaking up, what's your favorite team book?
I actually had a few, but let me talk about the weirdest one. You know, it's really, really hard for comics as well as any other type of entertainment to get very far from politics. I mean, even books that want to be aggressively meat and potatoes, oh, there's that phrase again, you know, they seem to bump against politics whether they want to or not.
And, you know, comic book politics to me is utterly fascinating. I mean, you go back to, like, that this really amazing mix of the Golden Age politics, which are, like, very right-wing and patriotic, and they have, like, these really, really horribly racist characters in some cases. But on the other hand, you know, I think in the first five issues of All-Star Comics, they're appealing to the Brotherhood of Man, and, you know, they're trying to draw a clear line between us and those fascist countries. So you had this weird fermented politics in the 40s until the 70s, where you had those old guard editors running them against their hippie writers. And one of the many, many things that I think is sad about modern comics is basically you get three kinds of politics in modern comics. You get liberal, mega liberal, and Frank Miller. And don't get me wrong, I have absolutely no problem with liberals. I love liberals. I'm a political scientist. Their views are as valid as anybody else's. But just, you know, picking up a comic and it, you know, they're telling me, like, oh, this is this new daring political comic which is liberal as anything else being published today. Yawn. Okay. So for me in that climate, I think one of the really underrated team books that didn't get its due was Bill Willingham's run on Shadow Pact.
Because, oh, I love that.
Yeah, I mean, it had a lot of things I look for in a team book. It's a bunch of heroes, a bunch of underserved characters that Willingham did right by. They're a bunch of misfits thrown together under weird circumstances, taking on really weird opponents. Mm-hmm. But Willingham, perhaps the only sane conservative in comics these days, you know, the fact that every now and again he would throw in a bit of right of center politics, that made it fresh. It made it interesting to me. I mean, it was something outside of the liberal echo chamber that comics have become. And the thing is, he did it in a way where it wasn't obnoxious. I mean, if it's one thing that any political philosophy can do to turn me off is, it's when I feel like the writer's standing on my chest screaming his viewpoints at me. You know, I'm thinking about that god-awful god-awful Joe Kelly run on Justice League. Ugh. But Willingham, I think, did it well enough to make it at least interesting, thought-provoking, and at the very worst, not detrimental to what other superhero shenanigans were going on. So it may not be the absolute best hero team book ever, but I think Shadow Pact deserved better than it got.
Yeah, a lot of those a lot of those team books they put together that kind of highlight the B-list heroes. Mm-hmm. I almost think they have a freer rein to kind of do what they want.
Yeah.
Without the heavy hand of editorial direction, and then it's a shame more of them don't kind of succeed over the long term.
Yeah. But I have another one in that vein, but I don't want to eat up all your airtime, so please feel free to talk to other folks if you want to.
I'm guessing you're not a big fan of Grant Morrison's recent run on Superman.
Well, I appreciated the fact that Grant was like trying to make the 1940s Superman relevant today, you know, having him being this big, big social justice crusader. And that was kind of interesting. I mean, it sort of caught that, like, five-minute zeitgeist we got when we were all out occupying things for the 10 or 15 minutes that mattered. But it wasn't so much that he made him a crusader of social justice that turned me off. It was the fact he made him an asshole about it. I mean, talk about standing on somebody's chest and screaming your viewpoint. I mean, if the feet are Kryptonian, it does not make the burden any lighter. And it was part of my just general disgust between that and Mass Murderer of Steel. It's like, oh my God, can no one write Superman anymore?
I think Mark Waid could write him really well if they would ever let him.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, anybody can write Superman is not even allowed on the premises of DC's property.
He pissed him off really good and proper a few years ago. I'm not sure what he did, but
probably calling them out on their bullshit. If I know Mark.
That's not always a career beneficial move, yeah.
Oh, don't we know it. Don't we know it.
So, well, hey, going next around the table, Walt, let's talk about your favorite team book.
Oh, it started so long ago. You start reading stuff like the Iliad and the Odyssey, and you're just like, hey, look, a bunch of people getting together because, you know, they can't do it by themselves. But if you guys have ever seen Seven Samurai, one of the greatest, like, team movies ever, you know.
Kurosawa, yeah.
Just that initial scene when one of the main characters shaves off his top knot and pretends to be a beggar so he can go in and get the thief. I mean, that, you know, and then he starts inspiring these other people. But I really, for like that ensemble cast and stuff like that, love 90s X-Men, like from the cartoons. And now they're doing them, I guess Marvel's going to be bringing them back in a week, in a monthly. Yeah, that old series just really took a lot of the storylines that even though they didn't deal with those characters, and just put them in a format that you could engage with every week in small chunks. And when I was in the military, I could plug in on a Saturday and watch like two or three episodes, you know, because they would have them on varying channels and catch up. Whereas I didn't always have access to a comic shop. But I mean, those kind of team books, you know, that really ensemble cast where you had, you know, just the gamut of different personality types. You know, you had the mentor, you had the journeyman, you know, you had the the team leader, the the second in command. I mean, just all these different personalities working together for, you know, that common goal was really cool. But then aside from that, you also had the you know, the major trope of the X-Men, which is feeling like an outsider, even though, you know, you look or, you know, are taken as everybody else at face value, always feeling like the outsider looking in. You know, that just really spoke to me as when I was a lot younger, and still does to an effect. Although nowadays, you know, they got mutants turning into vampires, and you know, they got all these crazy events. Now the mutants are being sterilized, and I don't know. It seems like a travesty that they're taking all of that rich history that the X-Men have produced and just cannibalizing it because they can't get a movie license. I mean, it's just, I don't know. Although I will say that I do like a lot of the Inhuman stuff that that when they launched Inhumans number one, and Joe Madd was doing the art. You know, it was cool to see, you know, people coming into their powers and stuff like that. But the artwork really grabbed me because I really liked the sketchiness of Mad's artwork, because they were doing colors straight over the pencils with no inks. So you could, you know, when they were going with dark lines and stuff like that, you could see how his pencil work was, and that was pretty cool. But like, I also really really enjoyed Thunderbolts, you know, because you got all these like really vile people, you know, being brought together and having the government say, hey, we're gonna put a bomb in your head. You're gonna work for us. And that's the same thing with Suicide Squad as well. we're gonna make it so that you can't run, and you work for us, and we won't send you to prison forever. But, you know, somewhere in the midst of that story, you know, it's almost like boiling water, where you get, you know, the pure water can be strained off, and then any sediment just falls to the bottom. And that's, you know, you got the ones who would double-cross everybody, and you got those ones that had redemption stories. And that was really groovy because, once again, seeing in the military, there's tons of people that come from all walks of life, and you hear, you know, you get the ones that are like, you know, the goody two shoes and just wanted to, you know, serve the flag and all that. But the other side of that was you had the dude that was like, yeah, you know, it was either this or jail, you know. So, and then you see them now, 10, 15, 20 years later, they're responsible, productive members of society with families, you know, and these are former gang members, former thugs, thieves, you name it. But, you know, you give them just that one nudge and give them something to believe in, and, you know, you had the ones that failed, but more often than not, you had the ones that turned it around. So, yeah, stuff like Thunderbolts was really, really cool.
You know, oddly enough, it's either this or jail is the reason I became a professor.
I thought that was the reason for your wrestling career.
Shh. Wearing a mask. No one knows.
I will one day uncover your Lucha Libre name and mask. It will happen.
I'd read that comic.
Now that you said that, I'm going to have to produce that comic.
You know, Chris, I still want to see that comic you postulated in your Facebook page like 2 or 3 years ago. It was when they were shutting down advanced placement history classes
for
various reasons. And Why don't you describe that yourself? It'd probably be funnier.
Well, I think it was Texas that was gonna get rid of their advanced placement program. That was the main thing I was teaching at the time, and I was just postulating that, you know, if it became illegal, would I like have to do it in secret? And I was thinking mixing it with my rural Southern origins, like, you know, I'd have like this orange Dodge Charger, you know, like, you know, I got a suggestion called the James Madison, and you know, I'd be driving around, you know, jumping bridges, you know, teaching advanced placement government while running from the law, and while Waylon Jennings describes what I'm doing.
Pausing over every river. That
yes. Yes.
Would there also be still Boone Hooch?
Well, it's a family tradition for the McLaughlins. It'd work in there somewhere.
Nice. Well, Mr. Aid Smith.
Okay. Mine shouldn't come to a surprise of anybody. It's got to be the Alan Davis one on Excalibur.
I was thinking you were going to pick Captain Britain and MI-13.
You are. So, yeah, MI-13 wasn't as good.
Really? Okay.
Yes.
Well, tell
me why. Well, MI-13, I didn't like the actual team makeup of MI-13 as much as Excalibur. Excalibur had characters I cared about. Kitty Pryde, Nightcrawler, fantastic characters I loved from the X-Men straight away. Captain Britain and Megan, obviously, from the original series, is that as well. And obviously, then they worked a few other characters in there as well. But those core characters were really, like, guys actually cared about. I actually like those characters, and the idea of the storylines that they did were kind of always slightly humorous or slightly off center. They tended to, obviously, they did the first 15 or 16 issues with the cross time cable, we went to all the different universes, and it just gave the writers just kind of free range to just go, we'll just create another universe. This universe has got, I think, I remember there was one that had a waiting line with every version of Wolverine waiting to try and sign up for a movie role or something, and it was kind of bizarre. And that was pretty cool. And yeah, there was Daleks in there, and there was a few other things, and it was just absolutely kind of free reign, because it was like an X-Men book that had X-Men in it, but just off center. And at that point in time, like Walt was saying, the X-Men team, that was something I really loved, and eventually, that kind of just, I think, to be honest, like what I was saying, that when the movies came in, that is when I stopped buying X-Men. I tend to remember when X-Men came along, I for some reason, my comic store missed out on 3 months worth of X-Men or 4 months worth of X-Men comics in the stuff they sent me, and I hadn't realised, because I just wasn't, and then it was like after 4 months, I thought, crap, I obviously wasn't that interested, because obviously missing 4 months of one book, you should notice. So that's why I dropped it, and I'd been buying it for like 16 years or something before then. It's absolutely crazy. So, but Excalibur for me, that is probably the key book, I think, at the moment. The other one, given another one, would be Fantastic Four. Because Fantastic Four has obviously got a core, apart from obviously She-Hulk, of core of those four characters. And whereas you can, like all the other teams, it's like, oh, I like this era or that era of the Justice League or that era of the Avengers, Fantastic Four, generally speaking, is those four and that alone.
Is there a particular time period for Fantastic Four you like?
I'm going back and trying to read all the original Kirby stuff in the hardcovers, and that it's not easy, because they tend to be kind of absolutely crazy, stupid storylines, like with the Submariner trying to con them into making a film, and actually it's not a film, it's actually a trap for every single member of the Fantastic Four. Like, where the hell did that come from? That kind of gets a bit bizarre. I personally think for recent stuff, the Hickman stuff, I think, was really good.
The Hickman stuff kind of was insane, really, yeah.
Yeah. The grand gestures and the kind of, you got the idea that he was utilizing Doom pretty well, he was utilizing Galactus pretty well, and there was the idea, again, same with is what I've heard of the stuff up to Secret Wars, is that he had a plan, he had an idea of what he wanted to tell, it would gradually kind of pan out after whatever, 15 issues, 20 issues, and that was it, and that was really good. And the stupid thing being is, as obviously they did two more series after the Hickman run, the series after that, which I think was a Future Foundation series, which I absolutely love. That was really good. And then the one after that was pretty terrible. And then, surprisingly enough, that's when they canned it, because obviously with the movie stuff going on. So it's a real shame to see these characters just drilled into the ground that are, in my opinion, a core Marvel icon. They need to be there. They need to be in the Marvel Universe. Although technically two of them are still then just not if they're not there as a team, it's not right.
Well, I got a feeling they'll come back. Actually, there was even a rumor today that Marvel got the movie rights back, although that turned out to be false, apparently.
Yeah, it's a shame, because that would have been really cool. But then again, would another movie do any well? Because it would probably die on its ass, because everyone would go, oh my god, not another one, and that would be it.
There might be a limit to how many times you can reboot a superhero franchise within like a decade. But
ought to be.
Yeah. Yes, I always recommend people talk about Fantastic Four if they haven't read Hickman's run, especially like the War of the Four Cities. That is some of the I'm looking for the right adjective. You can tell it's well planned out, but it's also just kind of I don't want to say batshit crazy, but it's like batshit crazy in a good way, because he's incorporating a lot of history and some big fun ideas, and you don't actually see the curves coming. Some of the things you do. I mean, there being a multiversal legion of Reed Richards was kind of cool.
Yeah. But exactly, and that was why it was so good, because it was something again that you hadn't really seen before. The idea of like having Nathaniel Richards, Nathaniel Richards killing the other versions of Nathaniel Richards as well, and all this other stuff.
I'm trying to remember. There was an awesome scene at the end where Nathaniel Richards is, he's fighting off some. What were those huge big space gods coming for the planet?
Celestials. Yes.
Yeah, and he says to me, my Galactus. And that's freaking Galactus shakes up. Because Nathaniel Richards has worked it all out where Galactus is working for him now. So I might have a few details wrong. It's been a few years since I've read it. But yeah, that's a book that's well worth checking out.
Very good stuff.
Most of Hickman's stuff has been collected in omnibuses, and you can pick them up for pretty decent. So definitely worth checking out. Talking about my favorite books and the stuff I thought everyone else was going to mention, no one mentioned. So just a quick shout-out to Jeff Johns' run on JSA.
Oh, yeah.
Which was, a loving nod to, DC's history, just about every issue. But he also managed to work on interesting team dynamics. And I was really unhappy when they said, I like Willingham, but when they handed the book off to him, it was never really the same again.
When was that? Was that just
It was after one year later. It was after 1 year later. They rebooted with a new number one.
Yeah.
But you got to admit, even if Willingham wasn't equal to Johns at his peak, I thought Johns was falling apart towards the end of his run. I mean, when there were like 700 people on the team, most of whom had gotten like a one panel introduction.
There was kind of a bit there where I was like,
what
happened to Sandman? He was an interesting character, and they kind of quit talking about him because they had to work in Cyclone. And
yeah,
I remember there was one issue. They had a big splash page of Cyclone at the dentist getting her braces off.
Yeah.
And then like every team member was there in the room with ice cream cheering for her to get her braces off. So that on one hand, it's nice there's a comic book that can be that sentimental, whatever you want to call that. On the other hand, I'm pretty sure Wildcat has other places he wants to be.
I liked it when it was about the Justice Society. When it turned into the Legion of Super Justice Society, it was not nearly as good a book.
Because the storyline I remember is when they were rebuilding the town. That was just before the reboot.
Oh, God.
This is Red Beetle. And you go, what? Who the hell's Red Beetle?
So,
Where did he come from?
Okay. Some of the most fucking terrible comics I have ever read is the post-Bill Willingham JSA. Maybe the absolute worst comics I've ever paid money for.
And, of course, crikey. Green Lantern's costume redesign as the big lantern.
Yeah.
I mean, what was that? That was crazy. That was like, that was literally like we're trying to design a Transformer toy that could turn into Green Lantern into a lantern and the character. Just stick his legs inside his chest and he's a lantern. Hooray! That was mad.
Wasn't that a nod to Kingdom Come?
Well, if it was almost there, but the one on Kingdom Come was so much nicer.
Yeah, and then he builds to his master villain whose only superpower is that he's an asshole and he can somehow hold off all 700 JSA members single-handedly.
it was just weird.
Skull fuckingly terrible.
It was just so, because it just like you say, it was just like, oh, all of a sudden we're here, we're doing this, we're doing a tech, we're rebuilding a town. Here's yes. seven members you've never seen before.
Yes.
What? When? What? Huh?
The day I lost faith in the International Criminal Court was the day they failed to indict the guy who was writing Justice Society then.
Hey, one other book I wanted to mention that I don't think has any love is Dan Slott's Run on Mighty Avengers. And it kind of has some of those big, you know, big crazy ideas like Hickman's Run on Fantastic Four. There's an infinite Avengers mansion that Hank Pym builds out in, you know, cross-dimensional space that's shaped like the Wasp and actually contains her essence from when she got blown up in Secret Invasion. So, yeah, there's some crazy stuff. And it's all the B-listers. It's like U.S. Agent and Stature and Jocasta and...
Sounds like a West Coast Avengers team.
Yeah, it wasn't different from that, but it was. It didn't take itself too seriously, but it still kind of delivered, you know, fun action beats, you know, along the way. Loki was the main villain. He was masquerading as Scarlet Witch, and no one really cared for it except for me, as far as I can tell. It ran for a couple years, and then got canceled unceremoniously. But
Didn't White Avengers kind of just fade? I don't even remember like a grand announcement that it was being canceled. It just kind of 1 month, it just wasn't on the books anymore. It just seemed to be really.
That is exactly true. Like when they have a TV show, you're not sure if they're going to renew for the next season, and they're not sure, so they don't really have a finale episode. And then they're just like, you know, we're done. So.
Yeah, exactly. And it's kind of like September, and you realize wasn't it supposed to start in March if it was coming back? Yeah.
Is that the one where they declared that Pym was the scientist supreme?
Exactly. There was a scene where the Marvel personification of the cosmos actually showed up and was kicking Hank Pym's ass. And he was all like, you're doing this to yourself with your self-esteem problems. And it's kind of goofy, but it kind of worked for me. I don't know how else to say that. But it not for many other people, because as I pointed out, it was canceled after a couple years without, you know. So that's worth checking out. The aforementioned Captain Britain and MI6. Mm-hmm. That at least got a finale episode. But basically it was the team from Excalibur. Well, that's not fair. It was Captain Britain, Peter Wisdom.
Yeah.
Pete Wisdom, Black Knight, Blade. I don't know how
it
Blade
was. It was the latest team of Excalibur. Yeah. It was not the cool era of Excalibur.
All right. Spitfire, and I wish they gave her a different name because I don't know how to pronounce Faiza Hussein. And it was just fun. They fought Dracula on the moon. It was that kind of book.
Spaceships. Yeah, it was cool. Yeah.
But and we just had a podcast about team books, and no one mentioned the Giffen DeMatteis run on Justice League. How is that possible?
See, that's the other thing. That was the other thing I was going to say. If I went to to DC rather than another Marvel book. Yeah, the JLI with Booster Gold, Blue Beetle, and Nort. I mean, that's all I need.
Yeah, I would love. Actually, you can't. There's Justice League 3000 right now, which is written by those same guys. With actually Booster Gold will be a lot. Yeah, they are in there. They're on a prison planet or something. So yeah.
Right. So this is one I don't know. There, Justice League 3000. What's the difference between that and Legion of Superheroes? Because isn't that like also the year 3000? I mean,
yeah, you would think.
The big difference is
Legion
of Superheroes got canceled, and this is their attempt to keep that era alive.
As far as I'm aware, Justice League 3000 is technically not right. Okay, right. The reboot, the new 52 version of Legion of Superheroes, may be the future version of Earth 2, not necessarily the future version of Earth 1. Justice League 3000 may be the future version of not Earth 1 as well. It may be a future version of another Earth that was introduced to Multiversity. So there you go.
Wow.
See?
Nope. Damn, makes perfect sense.
What about the Legion of Substitute Heroes? Are they going to have come back or something? Because that would be cool.
No room for them in all the Grimdark.
Yeah, exactly. Or Legion of Super Pets. There you go. You know,
I just want to point out, Chris.
Yes.
That Squirrel Girl had a successful monthly very recently, and she's on an Avengers team now.
Mm-hmm. Isn't she also the nanny for Jessica Jones and Luke Cage's baby?
I think you are right, yes.
That was one of my favorite comic pages in the last last few months was getting to see like the job interview of them trying to get someone to be their nanny, and finally getting Squirrel Girl to do it.
I gotta tell you, it's goofy as hell, but I enjoy Squirrel Girl more than any other book I read on a monthly basis right now. and she's cooked. She's almost a team book now. Although I don't know after the whole Battle World, Secret World bullshit.
It's really good. I'll say again, it's really good. Secret Wars is a really good book.
For a while there, she's running out with a couple other animal themed teenagers like Koi Boy.
Koi
Boy. K-O-I.
That's genius. Okay, that is genius.
So, Chris, sorry, McLaughlin, Professor McLaughlin.
I actually prefer Christopher, if you want to use that to tell us apart.
Okay. Cool. Christopher.
Yes.
You had mentioned you had some other thoughts on team books, but you were putting them on hold so that you would.
Yes. Well, I had a couple of obvious ones I just wanted to mention in passing because, so we don't get like angry mail or anything. But you know, we all have to bow in the direction of Grant Morrison's JLA. Okay, awesome, without question. You know, I'm probably, you know, and Gail Simone's Secret Six, another awesome book that deserved every bit of praise that it got. But a couple that I think didn't get the praise it got was, I am a huge, huge fan of Jimmy Palmiotti and Justin Gray's Resurrection of the Freedom Fighters. Because, I mean, to me, that was just the perfect way to update an ancient character and ancient concepts for the modern day. Really good stories, well told. When they had Daniel Acuna doing the art on the first couple of arcs, it was just stunningly beautiful on top of everything else. And by the time they got to the regular series, they had done this masterful job of taking the really, really scattershot elements of the huge amount of comic books that Quality put out, and were starting to weave them into this like almost alternate DC universe with its own history, heritage, and traditions kind of running alongside all the other DC mythos. And I just thought those guys just absolutely nailed not only how to do a team book, but how to reinvent a concept. And I just fabulously, fabulously good books that didn't get anywhere near the credit they deserved. You know? And I will stand in line with a million Harley Quinn fans. I do it every year at Baltimore just to thank Jimmy Palmiotti for the Freedom Fighters. And you know, maybe he's just practicing. He seems to really appreciate that, you know, somebody actually read that. So you know, I got that going for me. And my other long neglected book is. The team book that actually helped get me into comics was, I will, to my dying day, be a huge, huge fan of the original Defenders, especially when Steve Gerber was writing them.
Oh, just for people who might not have lived back in the day like you and I did, could you refresh us on who were in the Defenders?
Well, you see, that was part of what was great about the book. Because at the time, you know, I was like 7, 8 years old, and my universe revolved around getting comic books on Friday or Sunday, depending on you know, her parents, and staying up way too late and watching the original Saturday Night Live. And just there's something about reading the Defenders and watching Saturday Night Live, because the two great things they had in common was you only had the roughest idea of what was going to happen from issue to issue. You know, there were some recurring characters in the Defenders, but you never knew when they were suddenly going to swap them out or throw in a guest star out of left field, like Hawkeye or Moon Knight or somebody like that.
It's like, we've got this team with Valkyrie and Doctor Strange and Hawkeye.
Yeah.
What the?
Yeah.
Because we totally need Hawkeye.
Yeah. And I was reading that at the same time, like I said, I was watching the original Saturday Night Live. And I remember the episode where Paul Simon was the announced guest, but out of nowhere, George Harrison showed up. And the two of them did a little acoustic set together. And just absolutely blew me away, you know, the fact that, you know, that, wow, entertainment can be like this. It can be unpredictable and cool. And the Defenders, to me, was always kind of like the Saturday Night Live of comic books. You were never really sure what was going to happen in it. And with Gerber writing it, I mean, Steve Gerber may be the most brilliant man ever to work in comics. I don't know if he was the best comic writer ever, but God, he was so imaginative and so tuned into what was going on in the world. And just writing this odd little book, you never knew what was going to happen in it, about a bunch of odd little people who have nothing in common except they're all kind of odd in the same way, and they're marginally saner than the insane world around them. I mean, seriously, I mean, it, throwing in stuff like Elf with a Gun, you know, the episode where they fight the team of villains who've all gone to a motivational speaker, and that's how they decided to form a villain team, was this motivational speaker got them pumped up about being better supervillains.
Wasn't that how Scientology got started?
I see someone does not know his Lord and Savior Xenu, eh? But yeah, it was such a wonderfully odd little book, and I don't know if anything ever has or ever will be published quite like it. And it's funny, even after Gerber leaves, they Marvel seemed to know what they had. They would bring in guys like David Anthony Kraft, who kind of kept that Gerber-esque vibe going. I remember one of Kraft's arcs, a character saves his life with a can of Schlitz beer.
Schlitz.
Saves his...
Yeah. That happens every day.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, but I mean, like, how many comics have you read where the hero is saved by shitty American beer?
It'll never happen in a Grant Morrison book.
You know, maybe sometime down the line in a Hawkeye book. You know, I can see Hawkeye doing that, but still in all, you know, not something you see every day. So, you know, the Defenders I unapologetically love, and it will never, the Defenders, if anything, they're a running gag in like Twisted Mego theater. They get any recognition at all. But to me, just a darn fine book in so much of its era. And really, just I it's one I love to go back and reread. And hey, I will give him one more piece of credit before I shut up. I definitely think it captures that outsider superhero vibe right even before the classic Claremont run on X-Men took that and just took it to another degree. But you know, you can almost see one book sort of paving the way for the other. And yet, even after that, Defenders keeps its own weird thing going. So I give it all the credit in the world for that. And I'm done.
The irony being is, obviously, Marvel are actually going to be republishing a lot of that Defenders stuff because of the Defenders Netflix series that's coming out, even though the characters in the Netflix series have got nothing to do with the ones in the comic books.
I know.
Which I think is brilliant. It's Defenders. They'll buy it. Don't worry. That's not the character. Don't worry. They'll buy it. They'll buy it. So I'm actually quite looking forward to it because I'm actually probably going to go and buy it for the reason that it's the original stuff, not as anything to do with the Netflix show. So.
Oh, gosh. You know, they're not going to do Nighthawk. To me, the original, he even more so than Doctor Strange. I mean, Nighthawk is a rich guy who still is an incompetent rich guy. I mean, it's an archetype you don't... It's not even an archetype. It's the only time you see that. The incompetent rich guy who's also a fuck-up superhero. I mean, it's just such a nutty little book. Love that so much.
I was going to make a Donald Trump joke when you said incompetent rich guy, but that almost seems too on the nose and obvious, so I'm not going to say anything about that.
Nighthawk has a good heart rather than one that he probably stole from an 8-year-old orphan, you know. So Nighthawk is a guy you can actually kind of sympathize with to agree. So you know, a little different.
Yeah, isn't he kind of one in Marvel's long string of this guy's kind of like Batman?
He started out that way, but when Gerber gets a hold of him and shows that, you know, he's a superhero. Batman is this like sort of idealized perfect human being. Other than the fact that he's rich, Nighthawk is a total fuck up. And it's just he's trying to be a hero just to make up for all the previous screw ups in his life, and you know, and even as a hero, he's maybe batting like 500 on success versus screw ups. And you know the fact that despite his wealth, he's so error prone. You know, he's a guy. He's like maybe the one rich superhero I can kind of identify with on some level.
Oh, cool. I'll have to check some of that stuff out when I get a chance.
Yeah.
Well, hey, Mr. Rutkowski.
Yes.
I think this is the part of the podcast where we awkwardly segue into Kickstarter promotion.
Oh, nice. Well, yeah, so I have this Kickstarter going called Bash Fantasy Legends of Steel. Aid actually contributed some of the artwork for some of the interior artwork.
Man, Aid does everything.
Yeah.
That would be me.
Yeah.
I did that.
And it's basically a grim and gritty sword and sorcery RPG, where it's meant to kind of evoke the sword and sorcery comics of like the 70s and 80s and cartoons too. Although this one's not rated for kids, or this is not a kid-friendly product. It's more of a you know, what are the comics ratings for the age 14 and up or something like that? it's not for the little ones, but yeah, it's basically it's an update to the Bash Fantasy system. If you want to check it out, the place to go is tinyurl.com/legendsofsteel.
Okay. And looks like you have met your goal with about 20 days left to go.
Yeah, we got about, yeah, I think like 19 days or something left. We do have some stretch goals because basically what I said, it's a standard sword and sorcery world, so it's not the high fantasy tropes that you would have got that you might expect from, say, the original Bash Fantasy, which was more of a toolkit system. This is more. It's a specific sword and sorcery world that it was crafted for. So there's no elves, there's no goblins, it's just humans are like the main playable characters. There are monsters and stuff, of course, but a lot of the high fantasy tropes like the elves and goblins and stuff are not in the book. I did make some add-on content with that material in it. So as we hit some stretch goals, I'm going to be augmenting some of that add-on content as well, which the current stretch goal was $1,600. It's getting pretty close to it, but that was to augment some of like the magic book and the fantasy folk like races book, magic add some magic items to the book and so on. But as far as like the core book, the Legend of Steel book is done. It's done already.
Okay. Well, hey, Chris, let me say I'm a big fan of superhero games, and just hypothetically, let's say, you know, my average listener is probably a guy who's a fan of comic books and superhero games. He's probably heard of Bash, maybe played it once or twice. Sell a guy like that on this particular Kickstarter. What sort of comic book fantasies are we going to be breathing to life with this rule set?
Well, the rule set is going to be evocative of like a Conan, a Red Sonja, a comic vibe, and it's not about like the typical tropes of like a Dungeons and Dragons-ish type game where you have to keep track of all your equipment and you keep track of all of your coins and all this stuff. It's not about resource management. It's about kicking the door in and going in for adventure. And the characters, basically, they're not necessarily the good guys. They're tough guys going up against worse guys. And so they're just trying to survive in this really rough and gritty world that's around them. It's basically more of it's not evocative of like a medieval Europe. It's more evocative of like a ancient Mesopotamian type region of what this world is like. So it's meant to be somewhat evocative of like those comics and the basically the feel that you get from that. So like the feel that you'd get from
so like Skull Kickers, Warlord, that kind of thing.
Exactly, Warlord, Death Dealer, even Xena Warrior Princess, you know, Grey Malzer, like that kind of stuff is supposed to be in there. So there's room in it for comedy. It's not all grimdark. There's definitely room for some camp and stuff in there as well. But it's not a four color superhero game. For those that are familiar with Bash, it's the rules are somewhat different. It's the same core system, but it works on a different scale. So we have what we call heroic scale and super heroic scale. So this is heroic scale. This means characters can and do die. You don't just soak damage just because of how strong you are. A person who's a really strong barbarian can't just get stabbed 100 times with knives and ignore it, that you can die by cuts. So it's...
But then your girlfriend can take you out to the head and draw some runes on your body and fight off the guys.
Say that again.
Back, right?
What was that?
Then your girlfriend can take you out to the desert and draw runes on your body and bring you back, right?
Oh, that kind of thing would be, yeah, for a plot device type of a thing. Magic, that one of the tropes and conceits of this of the setting is that magic is pretty much most, like 90% of all the people that use magic are evil, like 90% of them. So
just PC, like in the real world, then.
Yeah, so the players can be magicians, but they're assumed to be maybe part of that 10%, hopefully, that aren't evil. But that said, magic is supposed to be rare and special and unique, and for that reason, a player character who is a magician is going to have not be doing flinging fireballs left and right while flying and turning invisible. It's going to be much more low key. What they do with their magic, but because it's more rare, the effect that how profound the effect it has is going to be augmented because they're one of the few magicians anyone's ever seen, and one of the fewer still that anyone has seen up to any good with their magic.
Okay.
What led you to go with Legends of Steel versus the toolkit? Because one of the things that makes Bash and a lot of the Bash systems stand out is you always have these great sections where you break down the different genres within within a trope. So, like for Bash Ultimate Edition, right in the back of the book, you have Silver Age, Golden Age, Cosmic. You know, and it breaks it down wonderfully. Breaks it down into the different types of adventures you can have with superheroes. Will we see a section like that in Legends of Steel? And what led you to go from...
In Legends of Steel, there's a section right at the beginning about tropes of the sword and sorcery genre. So it's more like a magnifying glass on that particular subgenre of fantasy. So, for instance, I'll just pull up right here. It's not necessarily about barbarians. It can be about, you know, street urchins inside of a city. It can be about is this going to be about grim and gritty type stuff, or is it going to be about people with sun swords doing somersaults and you know, depending on what you it can evoke different things. So Thundar the Barbarian could be just as much an influence to your campaign as something like Fritz Lieber, for instance. So Michael Moorcock or something like that. So you and it looks at different subgenres though. So there's the pulp and paperback type of sword and sorcery, the comic book sword and sorcery, the animated sword and sorcery styles, and it kind of looks at all of them puts a little bit of a focus on them and kind of compare and contrast them for the reader. But it's not a raw fantasy book in the sense that it's a toolkit system like the original Bash Fantasy was. The book contains the rules that you need to make like your high fantasy type characters. So, for instance, in here there are the rules for powers. There's a section on special powers. Because there's monsters in the book, you have to have the rules in there for all the abilities that the monsters have. And with those, you can make just about any fantasy race that you want. But I don't have them pre-made in the book. I do have that as an add-on to the Kickstarter, though. That someone can choose to add on to theirs. And so if you want to have elves and goblins and stuff and you don't want to build them yourself, which you certainly can out of the rules in the book, I have that as add-on content. That's a $5 add-on. It gives you like over two dozen fantasy races or 30 fantasy races or something that you can... They're pre-made that you can throw in there. if you want. But yeah, so it's not a toolkit system. It's set to this world. And I think the reason I chose this particular setting would be that it's I wanted to do something sword and sorcery based. I wanted to do something kind of different and more focused on a particular genre. And I like the idea of doing a book that had a setting, all right, that was evocative of that genre and stuff, rather than having it be generic. Now, someday in the future, probably will be some more toolkit material, especially about the different subgenres and stuff of fantasy. But this is a book for if you want to do sword and sorcery. You can certainly use the rules to do high fantasy. In fact, one of the add-ons we have is Bash Sci-Fi, so you can even combine those two books together and have a spaceship land on your sword and sorcery world if you want to. But this one is dedicated to this one sword and sorcery world of Orisa.
Now, going back into what you have with somebody's mic is on. There we go. Going back into what you said about, you know, you wanted to have a focus setting for the Bash Fantasy rules that, you know, could allow you to build all that stuff, but is really focused on the sword and sorcery. Are we going to see that same thing with, I know Clint Staples has done some really remarkable work on Knights of the Commonwealth and yes. And really wants to push that forward as Bash Sci-Fi. Is that something that we're going to see more from Bash, where Bash starts to focus on a certain element and gives you that standout factor that we're seeing?
It's definitely going to be an iteration of Bash Sci-Fi that's coming out, and then that's done with a third-party license. But the they're developing that right now, working on the Bash Sci-Fi update. As a guideline essentially for the rules how to update them. Basically using Bash Fantasy Legend of Steel as a guideline, because the mechanics of some things have changed from Bash Sci-Fi. Not a whole lot, but a little bit. To give an example, in Bash Sci-Fi, damage for ranged attacks was based on your mind stat because of how well you can aim or something. But we ended up deciding not to do it that way anymore. Instead, ranged weapons have a fixed damage multiplier, which pretty much all you do in Bash Sci-Fi is you take the listed damage and add 2 to it. So a blaster that does plus 4 DM now does times 6 damage if you updated it. So I kind of gave that as a guideline to them for how to design it. Basically defer to the Bash Fantasy Legends of Steel rules whenever there's a conflict over how to do something mechanically in the game. This is going to be kind of the outline, the base system for the future of the, the heroic scale games. Now, I'm still going to make, like I said, at some point in the future, a toolkit, but that's some undefined point in the future. So the next Bash Sci-Fi is going to be, it's going to be the Commonwealth setting, and then the current iteration of Bash Fantasy is going to be the setting of Orisa. There will be more stuff in the future, but that's for another show for sure.
Sorry, I was talking into mute. So at this point, I think we should call it a successful podcast and wrap it up. If you are interested in picking up a copy of The Staggering Work of Heartbreaking Genius that is Emerald City, drop an email to me at mikelaff@gmail.com. That's mikelaff@gmail.com. And just put Emerald City Giveaway in the subject line. And I will give one lucky listener this book. And I was joking about coming to crash on your sofa for a week. That won't actually happen.
It'll be 2 weeks.
Maybe 2 weeks. I was, but you know, if things get dicey with me and the wife, you know, just I want to think maybe my listeners would be there for me if it got down to that. So just putting that out there, you know, just think about it.
I have a 9-foot leather couch with your name on it.
Okay, thanks, Walt. I appreciate that. All right, so that is handled then. So giveaway handled. Anybody else have anything they want to talk about before we wrap up? Mr. Rakowski?
I guess if you want to check out my Kickstarter for Bash Fantasy Legends of Steel, I should also mention that the setting was created by Jeff Mejia. I did not originally create the setting. But the if you want to check out Bash Fantasy Legends of Steel, go to tinyurl.com/legendsofsteel.
Cool. Mr. McLaughlin, Christopher.
Well, Aide and Alex Thomas and myself, we're still cranking out the bad guys pretty much every week with the M&M Rogues Gallery series. So please stop by the M&M store every week and see what evil we've unleashed on the world.
What's the one this week?
I'm not sure. I've been told that two of mine got sped up because they're like horror themed, so they should be out by the end of the month. But you should see my creations, The Waxman, before too long. And for those of you that enjoyed them in Freedom's Most Wanted, there's going to be a new updated House of Usher. So Freedom City's most horrible family is back, and they're even more horrible than ever.
Oh, cool.
The last one I'm aware of is Mistress Hyde, I believe, was the last one I saw.
Yes, another one of mine.
Another one.
Yes. I'm enjoying this far too much. I'm sorry.
Sweet. Aid, anything else you want to mention?
I don't believe so. Christopher says, I'm still working on my... I think I've just put my fourth one through to... Green Running, and the fifth one is on the way as well. So,
okay, and Chris, there was a big news item on GreenRunning.com this week about the Cosmic Book, which was first announced on this podcast 4 years ago. Can we say when that's coming out, or is that just tempting fate at this point?
Was it four? Because the image I have in my mind is we're on like this psychedelic set wearing like bell bottoms and vests. And we've all got like huge sideburns and giant collars and wearing peace signs and granny glasses.
That's back when Blue Oyster Cult was my house band. Yeah, it's been a while. Yeah.
Wasn't Dolph Lundgren playing the Punisher back then?
Yes. I think I was on the show with like Iceberg Slim and Howard Cosell, you know. So, I do know that the goal is to have it out by the end of the year, and I could say, well, that's the great thing. I could say October, November, December. I've got a 33% chance of being right, whichever one I say.
You know, end of the year is just fine. Let's just say it'll be out by January.
Hmm. Yeah. They say end of the year, and I know I've got a little insider knowledge about the resources that they've put on the project, and I would feel safe saying end of the year.
Okay. Beautiful.
Even though, again, I just freelance. Don't yell at Chris and Nicole if it doesn't happen. But from what I've seen, end of the year seems extremely doable.
And the cover looks great. The cover is lovely. Yeah.
Oh yeah.
So cool.
Yeah.
All right, cool. Well, we look forward to seeing that. Of course, we've been looking forward to it from good part of Obama's second term and part of his first term. So we're really looking forward. I'm so glad you guys have that Titan's Grave money, and now we can start seeing more stuff like the Cosmic Book.
Well, my wife needed braces, so I Titan's Grave may be my all-time favorite M&M book. I mean, my all-time favorite Green Running book. Excuse me.
Oh, I didn't know you were involved with Titans here. I thought that was all Will Wheaton.
Oh, no, I misspoke. It's all Will and Chris. All I did was crowd control. That was my whole extent to that.
Okay, cool. Walt, anything else you want to talk about before we wrap up?
If people want to go and talk about more Bash stuff, they can go to Bash has a really active forum, and friends of the podcast, Ben Norman and a couple of other guys frequent the list all the time. That's bashtalk.org, I believe, Chris?
Yeah, that's right.
Yep. And then if you guys want to see some cross-pollination with people who love Bash, you can also catch some of us over on the Supers boards, which is superscbr.proboards.com. come on over and notice that half the people on one are also on the other. And then just for products coming out, we got the third in the line of Scene Stealers is going to be coming out. That's going to debut at AetherCon online role-playing game convention. And then we also have the last two goals for our Kickstarter, Echoes of the Future, which is a big adventure being done by John McMullen, and amazing art by Abe Smith. I can't. What's that?
For people who haven't listened to our podcast before, I just wanted to shout out the rules name just so they know what you're talking about. This is for the Supers Revised Edition.
Yeah, yeah. So we run Supers Revised RPG. And like I said, Abe did some amazing art. John's doing some amazing writing. And then we also have Skull, which was done by kind of like our homage to like Cobra, Viper, you know, all those guys. That's coming from Zenith Comics, Andrew Cullis. And so that's about 90% done as well. So we got a lot of good stuff coming out.
All right, cool. And I will just mention that Fainting Goat Games, my publishing imprint, just came out with an adventure for Savage Worlds, Icons, and Supers called Belly of the Beast. It's an Improbable Tales line. And our lawyer has advised us to not call it Die Hard and Dr. Fate's Tower for various reasons.
I saw that on Facebook. It left my ass off.
Yeah, we're not calling it that because, you know, there's lawyers and shit. But we're not calling it that. But it's $1.50. For Savage Worlds, Icons, or Supers, it's a fun adventure. It'd be great Halloween adventure. And now Pimp Mode is disengaged. And I want to thank everybody for listening and everyone for coming out. This was a great podcast. And we will catch you all next time on the Banff Podcast.